I think I should make the usual announcement about the Tamil preaching. The translation for the Tamil class will be led by His Grace Krishnachandra Prabhu. And for those of you who are interested in hearing the class in Tamil, please proceed to the third floor. I think he's already up, maybe. He's up already, yeah? Okay, that's fine. Second point is, we would really request devotees as far as possible not to sit on the red carpet that you see in the center and the red carpet which you see at the back. What happens is towards the end of the program, when we have a lot of devotees sitting at the end, there's no space for newcomers to come in. And sometimes we have noticed, even if members of the public want to come in, when they see suddenly a huge crowd jamming up the whole entrance, they may feel a bit intimidated and decide, maybe we'll skip it. It's happened a few times, and the devotees at the door have noticed the trend. So the last thing we want is to be responsible for members of the public not hearing about Krishna consciousness. So my request, devotees, is if you come in later, or if devotees who are at the back, like Gopinath Prabhu and Pushpa Gopal Prabhu, if you see devotees starting to cluster around that area at the back, right up to the lid, please tell them to move forward. We have plenty of space actually, so it's not a problem. Thank you very much. So this verse continues to explain the wonderful opulences of the Lord. The Lord is very special and extraordinary, Bhagavatam tells us, because He is extraordinarily opulent. Which means whatever activities that the Lord does is always not to be taken on the ordinary mundane plane. And similarly, whatever descriptions that Krishna is giving in this chapter, and also in chapter 7 of Bhagavad Gita, we find very nicely that all the wonderful opulences of the Lord in this material world, by which the common man and even devotees like us can take solace in and identify, has been very nicely listed by Krishna. And as Bhagavata Prabhu nicely explained to us last time also, it doesn't become difficult if we read and appreciate these chapters to see Krishna in everything, to try at least to perceive Krishna in whatever extraordinary circumstances we can find. In that way, we become more and more conscious of Krishna. And the whole aim of the movement is finally for us to be able to remember Krishna always, somehow or other. So this is why the Lord makes it a point in the 10th chapter and the 7th chapter to give us a clear indication that He is not just based in some faraway world, but this material creation is very much a product of His energy, even though the energy be inferior. But that does not mean that as devotees, we should take the inferior energy for granted. If we do that, we can fall into the trap where we think that this material world, our jobs are separate, our spiritual lives are separate, and very often what happens is we become separate personalities also. When we wear dhoti, kurta, tilak, we come to temple, we feel very spiritual. When we leave Lakshmana temple and we go to work, all the bad tendencies in us will surface. And if we ask devotees why is this so, they tell us because material world has nothing to do with spiritual world. So this kind of understanding should not be there. And that is why Krishna is addressing it in all these chapters. Here, Krishna is giving another two examples which are very wonderful for us to remember. And the purport is very transcendental because Prabhupada is giving us an idea further of the opulences of the Lord. Krishna says here that there is a horse known as Uchai Shrava. Most of us have read about this horse. The horse is described in Bhagavatam 8th canto from maybe the 5th, 6th chapter as being as white as the moon. That is the beauty of the horse. It is a white, completely white horse. And it was, as Krishna described, it was churned out, literally churned out, in a very special circumstance. That is from the ocean of milk, and it was produced as part of the nectar that was going to be achieved by the demigods. So of all the horses, Krishna has not chosen any other horse which is maybe in the Singapore Zoo or in the Singapore Turf Club, because we have a few of them there also. And He's not named that this is the horse that's going to be me or representative of me. No. He has named this specific horse because this horse possesses an extraordinary quality. Being nectarian and being produced from the ocean of milk, it is special. Therefore, Krishna has ordained it as a representative of Him. At the same time, Krishna goes on to say that there are elephants. But there is one very special elephant that also came out at the same episode at the same time. And that elephant is the famous six-tusked elephant known as Airavata. And this elephant later became the mount for Lord Indra, who is the king of heaven. And then Krishna also goes on to say that there are so many men in this world, but of all the men, I am not so and so, so and so, so and so. Of all the men, I am considered to be the monarch, the king. And the king is considered to be the king of men. So naturally the leader or the most extraordinary person, he can be considered to be representative of the opulence of Krishna. And here I would look at the point of the king first, and then look at the purport where the first paragraph on the journey of the milk ocean is given. When we look at the king, Prabhupada writes here that we must understand that a monarch or a king in terms of Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita is very different from what we may think of today. Prabhupada makes it a point to state that because Krishna is the maintainer of the universe, the king was also given a similar task of maintaining a smaller universe. That universe would be his kingdom. That universe is his kingdom. And the king in those days, or based on the principles of Shastras and Bhagavatam, were not appointed based on how many votes they could garner. This was not lex populi. That's the Latin phrase for vote by popularity. It was not the case of that. The only qualification or the supreme qualification needed for a king was not on physical merit, but rather on godly qualification. This is a very important point that Prabhupada addresses here. And the people's welfare in terms of spiritual background was considered paramount for the king. As long as that qualification was there, that person should rightly be considered to be a king. In the Kali Yuga, that interest for the spiritual welfare of the population is unfortunately lacking. And because it is lacking, the masses are not in the proper peaceful frame of mind to execute the devotional service. That is why Bhagavatam covers all areas of science of living. It is not that Bhagavatam is only in the air, that we speak about the esoteric, that we speak about the glories of the Lord in the Navadham. No. In fact, the Lord has come, as Prabhupada writes here, and he has found great representatives in the form of righteous and spiritual kings throughout the history of Bhagavatam. We find the first example here is the example of Yudhishthira Maharaj. And we all know that Yudhishthira Maharaj has been described in Bhagavatam as the principle and the embodiment of dharma. All religious and spiritual principles are embodied in Yudhishthira Maharaj. In fact, it was Krishna's supreme plan that finally at the battlefield of Kurukshetra, the entire Kaurava dynasty, the Kurus, would be vanquished, only to be replaced by the leadership and governance of Maharaj Yudhishthira. Krishna would not have been foolish to put a king who did not represent him if he thought that Yudhishthira Maharaj was below par. And we find in so many pages of Bhagavatam and in Shastras, the glories of Yudhishthira Maharaj is so wonderful as a king. A simple example that I can remember is in the first canto, 9th chapter. And there, when the battle of Kurukshetra has finished, and the entire Kuru dynasty has been decimated, and millions of men have been killed, and millions more of their wives have been made widows, the great king Yudhishthira Maharaj did not rejoice. In this modern world, if there is victory after a great battle, the kings would rejoice. And they would say that killing is part of the deal, or vanquishing an enemy is part of the deal. But Yudhishthira Maharaj did not feel that. In fact, at the beginning part of chapter 9, we find that Yudhishthira Maharaj felt great compassion for those whom he had killed on the battlefield. And he felt great compassion for those who were left widowed or who were left fatherless because of the battlefield of Kurukshetra. And Prabhupada writes in these purports of Bhagavatam very specifically that herein lies the great quality of a great pure devotee of the Lord, who is also a king. And how is that possible? Because a king must be compassionate first. He may have to do his duties, but it will never make him hard-hearted. A devotee of the Lord is always very soft in his heart, and he sees Krishna in everything. In fact, if not for Bhishma Dev's prayers to pacify Yudhishthira Maharaj and to make him assured that whatever he had done was actually in accordance with the Lord's will, Yudhishthira Maharaj would have continued to feel morose. So that shows you that the kings of the Sastric background were very completely compassionate devotees. They had no wish to kill unless it was absolutely necessary or based on dharmic principles. Then you find also the great example of Maharaj Parikshit. We have all been reading wonderful chapters of Maharaj Parikshit for the last year or so, beginning almost from the 14th chapter, 15th chapter, 16th, 17th particularly in the first canto of Bhagavatam. And we find that there are no words to describe the glory of Parikshit Maharaj, because here is an example of a king who was a devotee from birth. He was so exalted a personality that even at the point before he was born, in an embryonic stage, the good Lord decided that he had to be protected personally by Krishna when the Brahmastra of Ashwatthama came flying by him. How much blessed must be King Parikshit. And even when he became a king, Kali, who manifested himself at that point of time due to the will of the Lord again, could not find a single place to exhibit his pastimes, Kali's pastimes, because Parikshit Maharaj had kept such a tight and spiritual kingdom that frankly Kali had to come back to Parikshit Maharaj and beg him, "Maharaj, though you have sent me out and given me a list of places in which I should reside, unfortunately I cannot find a place like that in your kingdom." And Parikshit Maharaj was such a noble king that if someone surrendered to him, be he an enemy or be he a friend, he was duty bound to try and take care of that person to fulfill his obligation. And that is why Parikshit Maharaj ruled as a great king. And Parikshit Maharaj was ready at an instant to kill Kali, if you remember in Bhagavatam. But he did not do so for two reasons. One, of course, was the ultimate will of the Lord. Because the Lord wanted Kali Yuga to be sent faster so that we'll be able to start chanting the holy names of the Lord. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare, faster. So that was the Lord's hastening of the period of Kali. But it does not detract from the greatness of Parikshit Maharaj. And Parikshit Maharaj, out of his nobility, then allowed Kali to reside in any place where that great powerful metal known as gold, by the way, which prices are soaring and soaring and soaring in the world economy, wherever gold is, Kali will be there. So we should be very careful with gold, but that's beside the point. The point is, Parikshit Maharaj was an illustrious king. And I remember one very nice prayer that Parikshit Maharaj gave that shows us what a great spiritual king he was and why is it that Krishna has chosen the king as the monarch. I think the prayer is found in first canto. It is in 19th chapter, because he has 9 prayers there and round about 14th or 15th verse. There Parikshit Maharaj is preparing for death. He has left behind his entire kingdom. He has been cursed by this Brahmana boy. And based on the curse, he is to die in 7 days. And he will be bitten by this terrible snake-like creature. And at that point of time, Parikshit Maharaj, instead of holding on to his kingdom even more, shows us that he was completely renounced as a devotee. Immediately he dropped everything and he fell at the lotus feet of the great saintly personality Shukadeva Goswami, and therefore Bhagavatam is here for us based on the mercy of Parikshit Maharaj. And Parikshit Maharaj prayed at that point of time, Tatyeva Meghasya Paravareshu. He says, he addresses the Brahmanas, Vyasata Chittasya Griheshu Abhikshnam. He says that Krishna, who is the controller of the three modes of the material nature and all the material worlds, he has so graciously overtaken me. Krishna has overtaken me like a car overtakes a car on the road. And how has he overtaken me? He has overtaken me in the form of a Brahmana's curse. Parikshit Maharaj did not view the Brahmana's curse as a curse. If someone comes up to us and tells us, you know, I curse that you will die in 7 days, we say, oh, very sweet, this is very bad, how can you say such things? But Parikshit Maharaj did not feel that way, because he was 10% pure devotee of the Lord. That's why he is a monarch and that's why he is representative of Krishna. Instead he said, Nirveda Mulo Dvijasa. Dvija means Brahmana, Sapa means the serpent, Rupo. In the form of the serpent and the curse, Krishna has come actually. See how Parikshit Maharaj taught his subjects how to see the hand of Krishna even in the reversals of our lives. For devotees, it is very easy for us to see the good things and attribute it to Krishna. But when something goes difficult or an agitating circumstance arises, then it is very difficult for us to see that, even in this curse, there is Krishna. But Parikshit Maharaj is a true king, is showing the subject. He is teaching us how to die also. And in this way, he tells us, due to my being too much attached to graheshu, family life. This is what he's saying. Frankly speaking, he's not attached to family life. Otherwise, how could he have given up family life like that and sat down for 7 days the moment he heard he was going to die? So then he said, Yatra prasatto bhayamashudate. He says that even though I'm attached too much, because I was attached too much to this material life of being a king and taking care of my subjects, that is why the Lord, in order to save me, has appeared before me in such a way that out of fear, I must suspend myself from all activities and renounce from the world. See what a humble prayer this is. Parikshit Maharaj is saying that I on my own cannot renounce this world. But Krishna has come to in the form of fear and he has forced me now to sit down and remember him at the last stages of my life. This is the example of the exalted nature of a king. And when Parikshit Maharaj was asked, or rather, when Parikshit Maharaj knew that his end was coming, 2-3 verses later, he then chants a prayer which is so instructive for all citizens of his state. He says that if I have to come back to this material world again, and this is very relevant for us because only Krishna and Acharyas know, by their blessings, how many of us are going to go back in this life. We don't know. So if we have to come back, Parikshit Maharaj has told us what we should pray for. He says, Punarcha Bhuya Bhagavate Anante Rati Prasanga Chatar Ashrayeshu Mahatsuyam Yam Upayami Srishtim Maitre Astu Sarvatra Namo Dvijevyaha. It's a very beautiful verse. And we should have this prayer in our heart should we come back to the material world. He says, O Brahmana, I offer my respectful obeisances to you. I pray that if again I should come back to this material world, then I only seek 3 things. One, I seek the complete attachment to the lotus feet of Krishna. That is his first prayer. And he never forgets, never leaves the lotus feet of Krishna. Second, I pray that I will always have the association of the devotees of the Lord. Because then only you will be fixed at the lotus feet of Krishna. Without the association of devotees of the Lord, it is impossible for us to be fixed at the lotus feet of Krishna. Because Krishna is more happy when we are fixed at the lotus feet of his devotees than even at his lotus feet. And then the third prayer is a logical progression. He says then that I should always have friendly relations with all living beings in this universe. And that is the hallmark of Param Vaishnava. That he sees the hand of Krishna and he sees Krishna in everyone. So, these are the 2 exalted prayers we can remember from Parikshit Maharaj, which shows us the value of a great king and what he can offer to the material subjects. Then the last person who is quoted here is actually none other than the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and he is Lord Ram himself. Ram Navami is just 1 week away, and it's so nice that we remember the Lord. And we also remember that Lord Ram had a wonderful kingdom of Ayodhya. And we don't have to go into the wonderful pastimes of Lord Ram, but we know one thing. We know that when Ram Rajya came into being, that wonderful period of Lord Ram ruling the world was such a glorious period for his subjects that Bhagavatam writes that the subjects had nothing that was lacking in them. In 9th canto, 10th chapter, in the chapter entitled Lord Ramchandra Rules the World, or the chapter before that, I think it's towards the end, 53 or 54th verse, there is this point that is a clear description of the glories of Lord Ram and specifically his kingdom. There Shukadeva Goswami describes that in Lord Ram's kingdom, Nadi, Vyadi, Jara, Glani, these 4 things were absent. Nadi means the 3-4 miseries of the material world. The miseries inflicted by the material nature and forces beyond our control. Miseries inflicted by others on us. and miseries afflicted by ourselves and ourselves. They were not present when Lord Ram was ruling. Then Vyadi, there was no disease for the inhabitants. Then Jara, nobody became old during Lord Ram's reign. And Glani, no one was bereaved or sad. Then Shukadev Goswami goes on to explain, Dukkha, Shokha, there was no dukkha, there was no sadness, there was no Sokha, that means there was no lamentation. No one was lamenting, no one was regretting anything. And then there was no Bhaya, nobody was fearful of anything. Can you imagine, the Supreme Personality of Godhead was the King, why would you be fearful? There would be no cause for fear. And Klamaha, nobody felt tired at any point of time. Nobody. Can you imagine for the whole day, every day being fresh? We can cook prasadam endlessly, we can do kirtan endlessly, we don't have to go to work. I don't think in Lord Ram's time everyone was so anxious about work, because Lord Ram was there and all blessings was there. And then he goes on to say, Mrityuscha anichatam nasit. He says that death also was held in abeyance. Why? Because Rame Rajami Adoshaje. Because the Lord was present there, the residents in Ram Rajya, they could choose not to have death if they wanted to. They had a choice. This was how powerful the Supreme Personality of Godhead was in his reign as Lord Rama. So this shows us one very important point, that all the great kings, they are all representatives of Krishna. The qualification for a great king is that he always puts Krishna in the center, and that is true welfare of the subjects. And this is relevant to us, to all of us also, because wherever we are all mini kings. We can be kings of our household or queens of our household. Don't discount queens. Very often the queens of the households, if you play chess, you know the queen has much more powers to move around than the king. King just sits there, the moment he's checkmated, that's the end of the story. But the queen, she can move up, down, left, right, center, everywhere. And it is true also. What I mean to say is that we all are rulers of our little kingdoms. Ego or no ego, we have the propensity to run things. But if we put Krishna in the center of our activities, then the opulence of the Lord in terms of spiritual nature will always be present in the lives of those we have to touch in our circles. And that is very important. As devotees, it becomes our responsibility to do this wherever we are and in whatever situation we may be. That is why devotees become very enthused when we hear cases of devotees sitting down and preaching to someone, or having an opportunity to speak about Krishna to someone. And when we hear how inspired that person was to come to Krishna consciousness, that inspiration we derive from hearing is non-different from Krishna. Why? Because Krishna says in 3rd canto, 29th chapter, 39th verse, very important verse, there Kapila Dev tells Devahuti Mata, she says, Na kachit daito. He says that the Supreme Personality of Godhead is not dear to anyone. Nacha bandavaha, na dvesho nacha bandavaha. He is not friendly to someone, nor is he an enemy of someone. He is equal to everyone. But apramatam, he says there that those who are not mad, pramatam normally means mad, but those who are not mad, madly running after the worldly things and who are remembering him, to that group of people, Krishna gives inspiration for them to remember him. And to those who do not want to remember Krishna, then Krishna gives them death. This is a very important point, that whenever we are inspired in Krishna consciousness, that inspiration is not coming from our achievements. It is actually coming from the Lord on account of his mercy for our puny attempts to try and remember him. This is what we must remember, and this is the opulence of the Lord. So this is the beauty of the kingly nature of Krishna. The second part, which is the first part of the purport, is also very sweet, because it tells us that these two horse and elephant, they are considered very extraordinary. And Prabhupada writes in the purport that the entire episode of the churning of the milk ocean was in itself extraordinary. Because the churning of the milk ocean story, the episode of the wonderful pastime of the Lord, shows us so many opulences that the Lord had, and how he exhibited these opulences in just one episode and one churning of one milk ocean. The story comes in this wonderful episode of the Parsha of the Lord begins in the 8th canto. I think it's in the 4th or 5th chapter. But we know that the devas and the demigods and the demons were always at loggerheads with each other. And they were always fighting for supremacy in this material world. Very often, because the devas remember Krishna, whenever, of course, they are desperate, and whenever they are in trouble, which is good lesson for us, because at least we should remember Krishna in trouble times. Otherwise, we may forget him in all times. That is worse. So in trouble times, the devas would remember Krishna. And because they remembered Krishna, Krishna always protected them. But one time came, when one day, Durvasa Muni, whom we all know is a very powerful personality and notorious for quick temper and ready curses, he immediately, one day as he was passing by the heavenly kingdoms, he saw Lord Indra on an elephant. And wanting to bestow blessings on him, he took out a garland that was given to him, very auspicious garland, and he gave the garland to Lord Indra. It is commonly seen as a sign of blessing if a speaker or somebody takes a garland offered to him and puts it around the neck of someone. But Indra was so puffed up with the fact that he thought that he was in control of heaven and he had been controlled for some time, that he just took the garland flippantly and threw it down to his elephant. An elephant being an animal cannot know the value of garland. So the elephant just picked up the garland, threw it down and stomped on it. Now you can imagine how Durvasa Muni felt. You and I may feel something, but Durvasa Muni felt much more than what we felt. And because he is much, much more powerful in the Siddhi department than all of you here, it was very natural that he decided at that point of time that he would curse the demigods to be bereft of all opulences and power. And immediately as he spoke and left, Indra could feel at that point his powers just wielding away. And all the demigods suddenly became powerless and fatigued, and they felt that they had no strength to do any of the administrative functions in the universe. They all rushed to Lord Brahmaji. And Brahmaji rushed with them in petition to Swetadvip, the ocean of milk, where the Lord, and in his form as Vishnu, was residing. They chanted beautiful prayers in glorification of the Lord. And finally, the Lord appeared. And when he appeared in the form of his powerful voice, he spoke and advised the demigods and Brahmaji as follows. He said that first, what you must do now is that you must declare a truce with the demons. The demigods were shocked. We are mortal enemies. Why should we declare truce? We stand for the good. Why should we declare truce? And Krishna said something very relevant to all of us. He said that you should declare a truce now, my dear devas, because your time is not right. The force of time, who is not different from Krishna, is not in your favor. Have you noticed, Prabhu and Mataji, how sometimes you do something very much, extraordinarily, but no matter how much you endeavor for a pursuit, it is not time, it is not meant to be manifested. You can stand on your head upside down for 30,000 years, but if something is not going to happen according to the force of time, it will not happen. But if you decide that you want to cheat death, and you run to the ends of the world or ends of the universe, you find that at the appointed time, when time is not in your favor, Yamaraj will come walking. Or, if you're not such an exalted personality that he doesn't need to come personally, he will send his other servants, Yamadutas, and they will take care of the job. The point that Krishna drove home here, and we should remember, is that time was not in favor of the demigods. First instruction. Second instruction, he told them. Now that you know that time is not in your favor, declare a truce. Go and uproot Mandara Mountain, Mount Mandara. Very big mountain, completely made of gold. And of course, gold is heavier than anything else. So it's a very heavy mountain. You and the demons lift up the mountain, bring them to the ocean of milk. Bring the mountain there and drop it in. Then use the mountain as a churning rod and take the king of the serpents, Vasuki, and make him tie him around the entire Mount Mandara, and then use him as the rope to churn this mountain. Throw in some vegetables, creepers, drugs, and whatever else, And after you throw them and you have mixed the nice concoction, then what happens? Start churning the ocean. And as you churn the ocean, be patient and churn the ocean with undiverted attention. That's the word Prabhupada uses in the translation. Undiverted attention. Why? Because Krishna told them, many things will come out of the ocean. Many, many things that will tempt you to move away from your goal. But your goal is to obtain nectar. If you obtain the nectar which this great being who will come and present to you, if you take that nectar, you will once again regain your vigor and you will be powerful enough to fight the demigod, the demon, and regain the kingdom of heaven. So this is what you must do. And then in 8.6.23, I forget the Sanskrit, but I remember the translation. There, Krishna advised the Devas, with patience and peace, two P's, remember two P's, with patience and peace, he says, everything can be obtained. But if one is agitated by anger, nothing is realized. What a practical instruction for the devotees and for everyone. Every time we become frustrated or angry, we should know that the goal of our spiritual life cannot be realized. In fact, forget spiritual life. Even materially also, if you get agitated by something, you are not able to focus. But if you are peaceful and patient in executing the devotional service, then Krishna in his own time, based on his own mercy, at the right appointed time, he will give you the benediction of bhakti. So this is very relevant for all of us. So after speaking that, the Lord then told them, now go and see what you can do. So immediately Indra went to Bali Maharaj. Bali Maharaj saw, the demons saw all the devas coming and they took up all their weapons and decided, let's fight them again and kill them. But then Bali is very smart. He saw them and he said, look, they're not coming with any arms. Rather, they're coming as if they want to speak. So, let's speak terms. Let's see if we can come to some compromise. Let's hear what they have to offer. And then Bali Maharaj and Indra sat down and Indra spoke and told Bali Maharaj, this is what I propose. You and I get our team together, uproot mountains, go and get Vasuki, start churning the ocean. Bali said, what's in it for us? Nectar! And Bali thought, this is a good deal. And all his trusted servants also thought this is a good deal. Because the demons were thinking secretly that at the end or at the appointed time, we will grab the nectar. And when we grab the nectar, we'll drink it, we'll become stronger. So let them work hard, we'll get the result. But Bhagavatam tells us, and Krishna advised them that let the demons work hard, but their hard work will stop there. But you, the demigods, being favored by me and with my blessings and by following my instructions, you will achieve the result of the churning, and that is nectar. So that was Krishna's plan. Demon's plan was something, but Lord's plan was another. So then what happened? All the demons and the demigods decided, now we will be friends. And we will go for a common cause. But of course, you all know you can never be friends for long with a demon. It is not in their nature to maintain friendly relations. Anyway, they went to the shores of the ocean. They lifted out Mandara Mountain before that, and they carried Mandara Mountain. But halfway through, the mountain became too heavy. And the demigods and the demons were not powerful enough to hold. The mountain collapsed on them. And when the mountain collapsed on them, what happened to them? Their bones were broken, some sustained fractures. And some of them were badly hurt. These are what we call celestial fractures and celestial, injuries. So as they were lying on the ground, completely fatigued and not knowing what to do, even before we begin to churn the ocean, we are already in trouble. At that point of time, the Lord came on Garuda. Without even asking, the Lord came when he heard the cries of the demigods. In a few moments, he had just lifted out Mandara as if it was nothing but a toy. And he put it on his vehicle, his Vahana, Garuda. And Garuda was holding Mandara Mountain as if it was a flower garland. It was nothing on him. Didn't even feel like he dropped. And immediately the Lord signaled him that he should bring the mountain to the ocean. And when the Lord looked at the devotees, his devas, the devas, and he glanced at the demons alike, all of them immediately felt, I feel fresh. I now feel invigorated. We are now ready to do the task ahead. So then what happened? They proceeded there and Vasuki was ready. And at that point of time, Garuda being the natural enemy, so-called, of Vasuki, because Garuda and Vasuki, you know, they are naturally, one is food for the other. So Lord Vishnu, being entirely considerate in nature, said, Garuda, you can go now. And when he went, Vasuki came forward and he assumed his place in the center. The demigods with the Lord at that point of time went to the front, to the head of Vasuki. And the moment they went to the head of Vasuki, the demons got jealous. They thought, why they must go to the front? We should be at the front. There must be some trick there. Something is there. Lord Vishnu is there. So immediately they spoke. And their argument was, we demons are very expert in Vedic knowledge. We know all sastras and everything. So because of our great standing in society, we should be the ones in front. You hold the back, the tail end of the snake. The Lord laughed. And he said, alright. So they all moved behind. The demigods wanted to say something, but they remembered. What did the Lord tell them? Undiverted attention. The Lord also told them, resist any temptation to fight the demons. So they agreed, and they moved at the back. And the churning began. And as the churning started, hardly a little while into the churning, the demons and the demigods realized that there was no pivot to hold Mandara Mountain. So without a pivot at the bottom, Mount Mandara simply sank into the ocean of milk. And the demons found and the devas found they were churning empty air. No mountain. Everything went down. So at that point of time, again the demigods became morose. And at that point of time, the Lord appeared in his transcendental form of Kurma Rupa. And he came in the form of the transcendental tortoise. And Bhagavatam says that he lifted Mount Mandara so sensationally that he brought it so nicely to the edge of the sea. And when the devas saw that the Lord had assumed his extraordinary form, they became inspired. And the demons also felt inspired. And they started churning. And as they churned, the description of this wonderful Kurma avatar is amazing. Bhagavatam tells us that the Lord in the form of a tortoise was 800,000 miles long. That was his length. And Mount Mandara was huge, but it fitted very comfortably on the shell of the Lord. But after a while, the demons and the devas again lost stamina. And they began to tire of the churning. And at that point, the Lord also decided that I also must do some churning. On their own, these people are not going to be able to do the work they set out to do. So Bhagavatam describes that the Lord as the tortoise started moving his shell. And he started churning. Bulk of the work was done by Krishna. Credit went up to the devas and the demigods, or rather devas and the demons, for churning. And Bhagavatam says that this churning was no effort for Krishna, so much so that as the tortoise, the Lord tortoise was moving this wonderful mountain, it felt like an itching sensation. You know, sometimes you see some people, they have a scratch, they have an itch at the back, they can't reach it. What do? They go to the pillar and they scratch themselves. If you go to the zoo, right, monkeys do that very often also. But you find that it is a very common thing. And you'll also find something about an itch. At the beginning, the itch is the most pleasing sensation you can find in the world. Of course, due to our material monkey tendencies, when you actually start itching too much and you scratch too much, it becomes a wound. But the Lord is transcendental. The Lord felt that movement as a pleasing, itching sensation. And he just continued helping the devotees. And then, Bhagavatam describes to us, and this is the opulence of the Lord. The Lord found that the living entities in the form of the devas and the demons could not execute their function properly. So how did the Lord extend his mercy to them? One, he was under as kurma. Then the Lord entered into the heart of the devas in the form of the mode of goodness, because that was their mode. He then entered into the hearts of the demons in the form of the mode of passion, because they were passionate about the endeavor. And he entered into the heart of Vasuki, who was actually in the mode of ignorance. The Lord entered into each of these different categories of beings according to their superlative modes. And at that point of time, he did that, Bhagavatam tells us, to encourage them in whatever occupational duty and mode that they were in, so that they could continue their endeavor of what they were doing. This is the meaning of inspiration that we discussed in 329-39. This is what the Lord gives in our hearts. That is why in 7th chapter of Bhagavatam, of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that in man, I am ability. Ability. Paurusham Rishu. I am ability. Any ability, Prabhu said, Mataji, that you have, we should never consider that that ability is coming from us. If you can play mridanga, if you can sing, if you are good in anything in this world, any ability you have, Krishna has reserved it as his domain. It is not the exclusive domain of anyone else except the Supreme Lord. And here is proof of it. The Lord entered each of their hearts and encouraged them to churn further. Then the Lord appeared in another form, just above Kurma, above the mountain, 1,000 arm form of the Lord. If you see it in the pages of Bhagavatam, there's a beautiful painting of the Lord at the top. You know, he looks very, very glorious with his 1,000 arms. And he sat on top of Mandara mountain, and with his arms, he churned the mountain from the top. As Kurma, he churned the mountain from the bottom. As the modes of passion, ignorance, as the super soul, he encouraged each person who was there to continue. And when the devas and the demigods, or the devas and the demons, as they were churning, Vasuki, you know, in all the effort, started emanating fire. His exhaling and inhaling was so poisonous and so detrimental that it affected the health of both the devas and the demons. And they were coughing and all. How do you churn if you can cough like that? And at that point of time, what did the Lord do? He was at the bottom, he was at the top, he was in their heart. Then he sent rain, he sent breeze, he sent clouds, he sent winds. And the moment the rain came, it dissipated the thick black cloud of smoke around the devas and the demons. And again, he refreshed them in their endeavor. Who can have such an opulence? That is why Kunti Mata refers to the Lord in her prayers as Antar Bahir Avastita. Lord, that you are within and you are without. No one can claim for that except Krishna. And at that point of time, as everything settled down and they started churning very nicely, at that point of time, all the different items came. And the items that came were so powerful. The first item, if memory serves me right, was the cow Surabhi. Surabhi came. And when the cow came, remember, there was an instruction from Krishna to the demigods that whatever comes from that is churned, don't run after it. Don't covet it. Be undiverted in your attention. Your focus is nectar. And this is instructive for devotees. Our focus is not nectar. Our focus is the nectar of the holy name. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. Krishna, Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama. Rama, Rama, Hare Hare. This is our nectar. And if we remember that we should concentrate on this nectar, then this whole world becomes like a milk ocean. So many things will come out and pop up in our lives, isn't it? And whenever we see these popping ups, we should not divert our attention. What is that prayer that Kunti Mata says in 1842? Toi me ananya vishaya. She says, my Lord, ananya. Ananya bhakti means bhakti which is undiverted. Exactly that is taken in the journey of the milk ocean. Toi me ananya vishaya. Madhur, pati, asakrit. Very important. That my mind and my attention should be fixed on you, asakrit. Asakrit means continuously, without diversion. And if I do that, then she says, rati, udbahata, addaha. Then I may gain some attraction for you. And just like gangai vauham udanvati, just like all the waters of the Ganges and all the rivers ultimately flow into one sea or one ocean, may my mind and my heart and all my senses be ultimately engaged at your lotus feet, at your attention. So this is what the churning of the milk ocean is teaching us. This is the extraordinary opulence of the Lord. And after Surabhi came the dreaded poison. What is that poison label? Halahan. Yes. That poison was so powerful that the demigods and the demons were just dying. And at that point of time, all of them, under the advice of the good Lord Vishnu, they all went to Mount Kailash to see Lord Shiva. And there, they fell at the lotus feet of Lord Shiva, Param Vaishnava, and prayed to him and asked him to please save us in this situation. And Lord Shiva, being the most compassionate of all personalities, put his life at stake. because the poison was so powerful that he went down personally to the murk ocean and he swallowed the poison. And as he swallowed the poison actually rested at his neck level. And that is why the Lord is also described as one who is blue in throat. He's known as Nilasan. Nilasan. And at that point of time, in that last verse of the chapter entitled Lord Shiva Saves the Universe, another nice instruction for us is given by Bhagavatam. Safyante Lokatapena. The great personalities all over the world. Parama, no, Sadhava Prayasho Janaha. The great personalities of the world, they are distinguished by one characteristic, Bhagavatam tells us. They have extraordinary compassion for living beings and they are willing to go through any amount of difficulty just so that other living beings may benefit from Krishna consciousness or may benefit as a whole. Lord Shiva was ready because it was the will of the Lord that the murk ocean should be churned, and he was ready to take up any difficulty just so that he could do it in service of the Lord. And then Bhagavatam explained, Parama Aradhanam Tadhihi. Such a kind of worship is considered the highest form of worshipping the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is known as Purushasya Akhila Atmanaha, because he is present in everybody's heart. So the next time, Prabhu said, Mataji, we are in the midst of a seva, or we have an occasion, Gaur Purnima or Ram Navami that's coming up, and we find that there is a possibility of us doing some seva for the devotee, but it will come with great difficulty, we should not shy away from it. We should remember that the best way to please Krishna is to sacrifice. Some difficulty we must endure in spiritual life for the service of others. And when we do that genuinely, don't do it as a ticking off thing. Okay, today I endure this difficulty, therefore my karmic effects are better. Today I will help Prabhu because that is required from me. Right? The chapter says that. And in this way I should be exalted as a personality. Krishna is not foolish. Don't forget, he's in the heart. He knows how we are doing it, with what motive we are doing it. But if it is genuine like Lord Shiva, then the poison hala hala just went. And after the poison went, then Krishna tells us, Bhagavatam tells us, that's when the horse came. This great white horse, Uchchaishrava. And after the horse came, Bali Maharaj quickly looked at the horse and said, I choke this. I'm reserving the horse. Indra looked at it, felt, this is a horse befitting a king of heaven. But then he remembered, the good Lord told me, don't divert attention, right? So move away, concentrate. And Bali Maharaj took away Uchchaishrava. Then Airavata came. And Airavata later on became the mount of Indra. But at the point of the churning of the murk ocean, Indra resisted. Nothing was done at that point. And after Airavata, there came 8 other glorious elephants also. But the demigods remained steadfast in their objective. Then the beautiful gem of Kaustubha Mani, they manifested from the ocean. Then there's another, Padmaraga Mani, that also manifested. And Lord Vishnu himself claimed, he came and he said, these should belong to me. So devas cannot say anything when the Lord comes, right? Better hands off. Then the Parijata flower came. And the Parijata flower eventually made its way to heaven. But at that point of time, heaven was under the control of the demons. So Indra was still away from Parijata flower. Then the Apsaras came, the heavenly maidens came, and of course the Asuras decided they must be ours, since we are in charge of heaven at this moment. Demigods, mouth sealed. They were concentrating with undiverted attention. Then the great goddess of fortune, Rama, came. And at that point in time, because she was so exalted a personality, even the Devata's heart fluttered. And they thought, if we could possess such a personality, if she came and immediately she wanted to find someone who would be worthy of a husband. And of course, in the material world, you know, every time we think, all of us actually have this sacred belief in our hearts that we are the most handsome, or we are the most pretty, or we possess something so unique that someone else doesn't have it. If somebody smashes that in us, our self-esteem goes down the road. And in that way, each of the demons thought to himself, actually, I am better than the other demon. And each deva thought, I am handsomer than the other deva. But Goddess Lakshmi had no eye for anyone. She only had eye for the chosen Lord, and that was Lord Vishnu. So So in the end, despite all the exalted worship of the goddess, hoping against hope that something would come, in the end, the good Lord Vishnu was wed to goddess Lakshmi. And after that, the churning continued. And then Varuni, the goddess Varuni came. Goddess Varuni is the goddess in charge of all alcoholic beverages. Right? So, of course, when it comes to alcoholic beverages, the devas were not so expert as the demons. And naturally the demons decided we have to reserve this goddess because I think she'll be very useful for our entertainment in beverages in the future. So Varuni went with them. And finally, a beautiful being, described in Bhagavatam as the plenary portion of the plenary portion of Lord Vishnu, known as Dhanvantri, the father of Ayurveda, he appeared. Bhagavatam's description of him is so beautiful I cannot describe it. But when he came, he held this wonderful jar, golden jug of nectar. Nectar. And this was it. The demon stopped, the deva stopped, Vasuki stopped, everything stopped. And at that point of time, the demons decided, jump, because the nectar is here. Forget our truth, forget goodwill, throw friendship out of the window. This is our objective. And they grabbed. The demigods wanted to jump, but in their hearts they remembered the good Lord's instruction. That is the difference between a devotee and a non-devotee. At the point of a junction when we are there between the material attractions and the spiritual life, the decision to stick to the spiritual life and obey the instructions of the Lord will always keep us under His shelter. The demigods decided, Krishna told us, don't do anything, we will not do it. And they didn't do anything. They patiently waited. As they patiently waited, of course they were saddened. They began a prayer in their heart. Lord, what to do? They're going to take all the nectar. And this was the purpose for which we came for. And at that point of the time, Kurma, the Lord at the top, the Lord advised the devotees, be patient. And then the Lord took on another wonderful form. How many forms did the Lord take in the churning of the milk ocean? It's unprecedented. In one pastime, it is unprecedented. And the Lord took the form of the most beautiful female in the entire universe. And that was the form of Mohini Murti. And the description of Mohini Murti dispels all doubts that if the Lord decides to be the most beautiful entity in the universe, then the opulence of beauty is His single monopoly and domain. And no one can take that away from Him. And Mohini Murti appeared. And at that point in time, the demons were fighting between themselves. No, it is for me, it's for me. You are lesser, I'm more. Even between themselves, there was civil war. And when they heard the anklets of Mohini Murti coming into the picture, all the demons paused. And when they looked at the beautiful form of the Lord, even being demoniac, they could not but be attracted. Even if they were lusty in their hearts, they could not but help be attracted to the most transcendental form that ever has existed in this universe. And that is the Lord, in whatever form He chooses. So the moment they saw her, the demons decided to become very quiet, sanctified, because they had to behave like gentlemen before a lady. So then immediately they approached her and said, who are you? Where are you from? What is your name? Are you married? And the moment they found out that she was not married, each one of them came up with their own marriage proposals. You should marry me because I'm stronger. And another demon would say, marry me because I'm stronger. And then when they decided that this wasn't going anywhere, they decided that the best thing was to please her. So they said, you take the jug of nectar. We're all fighting, you know. After all, you know, it's our nature, you know. We are fighting, we don't know what to do, we are disagreeing. Do one thing. We trust you, 10%. We know that such beauty cannot be wrong. And they were right, it's not wrong, he was transcendental. And they said, you take it, you do with it as you please. You divide it equally amongst us, and we will listen to you. And the Lord gave them one chance, one warning. He said, are you sure? Or rather, she said at this point, are you sure, my dear demons? You don't know anything about me, you don't know where I've come from. The nature of women is quite difficult to understand. I cannot comment on that, of course. And the Lord said that if you want to trust me, you must be prepared for the consequences that follow. And the demons, of course, couldn't see all this, right? Like in the cartoon, sometimes you see the figure of dollars, all they saw was Mohini Murthy. They could not see anything beyond her. So they thought, no, you just keep it and you do anything. So then Mohini Murthy, the Lord said, go and take your bath, freshen up, get ready. Devas, you too, sit down in two rows. When I come later, I will distribute the nectar. And the demons thought, wait a minute, it's supposed to be with us. But they thought, no, don't worry. She's beautiful, she's wonderful, she'll take care of everything. And they all came back and sat down. And the demigods were wondering, now what is going to happen? How is the Lord going to do this? And the Lord started distributing nectar from the demigod side. If there was anyone else distributing nectar, their heads would have been chopped off. But this was the Lord. So the demons began questioning, why is she doing this? But then they thought, no. In deference to her, we should just keep quiet. After all, she's very beautiful. She knows what she's doing. Somehow they equated beauty with knowledge. And somehow they thought that this meant everything will be fine. And they just sat down there. They did not realize they were completely under the spell of the Lord. And the Lord made sure that every drop was going to be finished. But at that point of time, by the wonderful will of the Lord, one demon, Rahu, and we all know Rahu today, isn't it? Whenever you say, we want to get married, this is Rahu Kala, we should not. Or something's going to happen, Rahu is there. Why? So Rahu is a demon. He got the idea that Lord is actually Mohini Murthy. Something fishy is there. So what should we do? He went to sit on the side of the demigods. And the Lord actually gave him a bit of nectar. And when he gave him the nectar, Rahu began drinking. But then the Lord, being merciful to him, decided we have to stop the mercy there. Being demon, he deserved to be killed. And the Lord immediately, at the behest of the sun and moon, who could also detect Rahu, what did the Lord do? Mohini Murthy immediately dispatched the Sudarshan Chakra and chopped off the head of Rahu at that point of time. But because the head of Rahu and the throat of Rahu had tasted nectar, that part of him remained, in that sense, immortal. And that is why today, Rahu is considered great enemy of the sun and moon, because he is the modern equivalent of what we call an eclipse. When Rahu comes and he casts a shadow, in modern day we call it an eclipse. But the origins of Rahu is actually found in the churning of the milk ocean. And we may ask ourselves, why did the Lord allow Rahu to sit down there? Why? Prabhupada writes in his purport, because the Lord wanted to show the effect that nectar would have on even a demon. The nectar was so powerful, that it was coming from Dhanvantri, a plenary portion of the Lord. It was so powerful that even if a demon consumed it and was chopped halfway, that part could actually live on. That was the power of nectar. So the Lord had distributed all the nectar to all the demigods. There was no drop left. And the Lord decided, enough of being Mohini Murthy. Now he assumed his real form as Lord Vishnu. And the demons realized, what has happened? We have been completely cheated. They took up their arms and they said, now we will teach the demigods a good lesson. Don't fool around with us. Don't mess with us. Bad, bad move. But they have forgotten. The nectar, by the Lord's mercy, had gone into the demon or the devas. And the devas became rejuvenated. The battle that followed was so powerful and so fierce a battle. But in that battle, by the mercy of the Lord, no deva was killed. But all the demons were completely defeated. And Bhagavatam ends with the verse 8928. And in that verse, Bhagavatam very nicely tells us this point. The place, the time, the cause, the purpose, and the activity, as well as the ambition of the devas and the asuras, were all the same. Think about it. They were the same place, same time, same objectives. Everything was the same. But the difference was the demigods achieved the result. One result, and the demons achieved a completely different result. Why? Because the demigods are always under the shelter of the lotus feet of the Lord. They could very, very easily drink the nectar. But because the demons, not having sought the shelter of the lotus feet of the Lord, but wanting to do everything on their own perceived strength, without taking into account the opulence of the absolute nature of the Lord, attributing all powerful ability to themselves and not to the Lord, The result of that was destruction for whatever they sought. That is why in 331 of Bhagavad Gita it is nicely stated, Ye me matam vidam nityam anutushtanti manavaha shraddhavanto anasuyanto. These three lines are very important because Krishna says, those who follow my matam, my injunction, and how do they follow? Shraddhavanto anasuyanto, with faith. The demigods have faith in Krishna. They may not be pure devotees, but they have faith in the good Lord. And we should not get into the habit of thinking that they are beneath, because they are always asking for the material thing. The demigods are to be fully respected, because they are much, much more powerful. And they are able to summon wonderful prayers in Bhagavatam for the Lord, which we can never compose for the whole of our lifetimes. We can't come close to that also. And even then, at that point of time, Ye me matam idam nityam, if you have faith in me, and if you are not envious of me, the demons were envious of Krishna, but the demigods obeyed the law. And even though they were in a difficult position and it looked like they were going to lose that which they came for, because they continued to persevere in their faith of Krishna, because they had patience and peace, and they were not agitated by anger, the result was victory on their side. And that is so instructive for devotees. Because the opulence of the Lord is in recognizing that everything is coming from Him. That He is the source of all. Aham sarvasya prabhu. Both material and spiritual. Once we understand that everything is coming from Krishna, then we should understand that nothing belongs to us. And when we try to understand that nothing belongs to us, then everything that comes to us is coming by His mercy. And the demigods lived that for that period of time. And the Lord manifested His opulence in the form of the Lord talking, in the form of the thousand-handed form, in the hearts of the devotees, the demons and Vasuki, as the super soul, and through the modes of nature. The Lord gave the winds, the powerful forces of nature was used by Krishna for the benefit of His devotees. And when everything else failed, the Lord appeared in the form of the transcendental Mohini Murti to bewilder the hearts of those who did not believe in Him. These opulences are transcendental. And devotees who are connected to Krishna, they will also obtain these transcendental opulences. And what is this opulence? This opulence is only coming down to one thing, serving the lotus feet of the Vaishnavas who serve the lotus feet of Krishna. That is the only opulence that is necessary. From that opulence, all other opulences will flow. In the 3rd canto, 25th chapter, I forget the actual words, Kapila Dev says another instruction that is very nice. Na sarhichin matparaha shantarupe nam shanti no me nimiso nidhi dihi yeshamaham priyadma sutascha sakhaguro suhridam daivamishtam. He says that, my mother, please remember that the devotees of the Lord are never bereft of transcendental opulence. Never. No amount of time and no amount of weapon can take the transcendental opulences from them. Why? Because my devotees of the Lord are always yesha maham. They are always engaged in priya atma, in trying to please Krishna. And how do they do that? In the various forms of relationships they take with Krishna. Sakha, as friend, Guru Ho, as the Supreme Spiritual Master, Suhrido, as that He is our well-wisher, Daiva Mishtam, that He is our chosen Lord, the one and only in our heart. So the opulence of the Lord can come to us by His mercy, and if we are touched by His opulence, then by His mercy and mercy of Vaishnavas, we may make some progress in devotional service. And Bhagavatam ends in this chapter of the churning of the milk ocean by saying that anyone who remembers this chapter, anyone who remembers this wonderful pastime of the Lord churning the milk ocean, if he remembers it with submission, humility and devotion, he can be liberated from the cycle of birth and death. Which other story in the world can liberate you? Which top seller in MPH or Times or Borders can get you out of the clutches of birth and death except Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita? So please, we should remember Krishna and be very serious about studying Bhagavad Gita and Bhagavatam. And in that way, if Krishna wants, he may give us the ability to come to him and to come to him through the agency of him. Jai Gantara Srimad Bhagavatam Ki. Jai Srimad Bhagavad Gita Ki. We can take one question, maybe a comment. Yes, Prabhu, that's the last question.
Thank you, Prabhu, for the wonderful class. I was very Lord appears in the different forms of Krishna and Guru Maharaj for that particular pastime. And by worshipping Lord in that form, we get purified. How about Mani Murti?
Only Prabhu can think of such questions. This is his ability. Lord gives him this analytical mind. If we understand Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita correctly, and if we understand that last point that Shukadeva Goswami says, that anyone who can remember the glorious activities of the Lord, he doesn't specify which form, but he specifies the activities of the Lord, then in that form, if he remembers the Lord, he will be purified. The demons may have approached Mohini Murti with lust, and because they approached Mohini Murti with lust, they were bereft of the final objective, unlike the devas. So if we approach any material object in this world with lust, it means that we are approaching it without Krishna. Lust can be in the form of physical lust, but lust equally extends to greed and acquisition of everything material. The form of Mohini Murti we should always remember is also a form of the Lord. As such, we should remember and respect the form as we respect all forms of the Lord. Only the demoniac in mentality will assume that that form should be treated in any other way. Will that help, Rosie? Thank you. If there's no other question, and of course we've ended it because there's no time for any other further question, we thank devotees for having come together. We'll just chant the holy name of the Lord, because that is the best way for us to remember Krishna. For devotees who have come today for the first time, we are very happy to welcome you. If you have any questions on this topic, there are many senior devotees in the congregation who will be able to address it much better, and we hope to have your association. For now, we can just chant the holy names of the Lord very wonderfully. Now, this mic stand just gave out on me. So, we have to find a way. Ah, we have another mic stand. Prabhu, can you pass through? So, let us chant. No, this is for this. Let us chant the holy names of the Lord. It is very simple, but it must be chanted with love and devotion. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. Krishna, Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama. Ram, Ram,
this also has come out,
Rama, Rama, Hare Hare.
Thank you. Hindu Center program. Keep it in mind. Next, Following week, Monday, 14 April, is Ram Navami. We have been given the chance to sing. The only tricky thing is the timing. It's 10 in the morning to 12 o'clock in the afternoon. So, of course, most devotees are working. Prabhu and Mataji, it may be difficult. But we really appreciate if some devotees can find some time to come down, maybe take some time off, whatever. If you can do that, it would be good. And those of you who are not working on that day or on shift work with some time, please, the more devotees gathering together, the more we can glorify Lord Ram and the more happy everyone becomes. So this is the program. It stays 8 o'clock here, but our slot starts from 10 o'clock in the morning to 12. And it's very informal. We don't even sit on a stage, nothing. We're just sitting before their lordship. It's much better because you get to see their lordship. You sit here, can't see anything. But here you can see their lordship, right? So it's a good chance. Don't miss this opportunity. These are the two major programs coming up. So keep it in mind. More details about it. But remember, tomorrow's immediate program is actually the Bhagavatam program. Don't miss it. The next thing I want to introduce to you is, where is Joshua and Sindhu? Are they here? Or have they gone up? Okay. Anyway, we're all going to go upstairs. Sindhu Mataji, all of you know, she is... Oh, Joshua Prabhu, you're hiding behind the pillar. Just caught you there. Okay. Joshua Prabhu and Sindhu Mataji are... Yes, she's over here. Okay, I see her. They are going to get married in Mayapur Tham. Next week. Am I right? Next week. Okay? Invitation is open to all of you. Chances of you coming, physically, difficult. But mentally, spiritually, blessing the couple, not difficult to achieve. So, my humble request, Chandrasekhar Prabhu and Subhananda Mataji have been pillars of our congregation for many, many years. And their children are very good examples of how the younger generation of devotees have taken up Krishna consciousness. Sivakumar Prabhu is there, Sivakumar Prabhu is there.